This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl, and I want to start off by saying a big thank you if you've kept us company and you've listened in 2025. I've been seeing some of your yearly stats coming through. You've been tagging us in the amount of minutes you've been listening to Science with Dr. Carl, that it's your number one podcast that you've listened to this year, and it just means the world. Thank you so much for listening to each episode, for subscribing, sharing it with a friend, recommending it to people. It all means that the good work of Dr. Carl and science reaches the masses. So thank you so much from me. I'm Lucy Smith. This is our second last episode for the year. So if you want to ask a question live, you've got one more chance left. This week, we got into some curly questions. One that kind of made me a bit squeamish about toenails. We talked about osmotic action, aka the squirts, spider webs, and how to clean your washing machine. We had a bit of a follow-up from someone who we gave a challenge to a few weeks ago. So you're going to hear about that in this week's episode. Let's dive in. Carl, can you believe we've got two more of these to go?
What, today and next one?
Yeah.
And then we have a break.
Because
Coca-Cola had to increase their sales because they were no longer adding cocaine to Coca-Cola, so they invented Christmas.
I've heard about this. Isn't Santa Claus an invention of Coca-Cola?
Well, the popularization. Okay, so if you're following the Christian thing, like Jesus getting killed and then coming back from the dead, man, that is great. So Easter was the big one. Getting born, yeah, kind of. And then when Coca-Cola no longer had cocaine in it, they found that their sales followed the seasons, high in summer, low in winter. Low in winter, that's a whole quarter of the year. So they got together a mixture of Saint Nicholas, who was a saint who had done nice things to young girls in the 3rd century in Asia Minor, and then also was the patron saint of sailors of the Dutch nationality. And he was sort of hovering in the background, and they married him to some other guy who was a thief in Scandinavia. What was the other guy who they called Sinterklaas? Sinterklaas.
Yes.
Okay. And he could dislocate his shoulders, and he used to go down chimney sweeps. So on one hand, he'd come down at night and rob you, but on the other hand, you had a clean chimney.
They kind of amalgamated the two.
They amalgamated the two, then made him big and fat and jolly and gave him the Coca-Cola colours and then the Coca-Cola red cheeks, and it kind of took off. So, yes, happy commercial soft drink day.
So, hang on. Coca-Cola used to have cocaine in it.
When they said it would give you a lift, yeah, they weren't lying. It was truth in advertising.
Wow.
And then they took it out.
Okay. Either way, that is why we are going. We're going on a break over Christmas and New Year's. So if you want to ask Dr. Carl a question, you've only got a couple more opportunities left.
Okay, last diversion. When I was a very rigorous Catholic, I used to learn the 7 holy days and I would recite them to my father, and it was different in Australia versus Poland. He said, New Year's Day? Who is this Saint New Year? Why is that a holy day? Okay, now to the audio. And we won't even talk about Formula One teams making cardiac surgery safer. We'll leave that for another time later
what?
In the day.
What? Okay, maybe later on in the episode.
Okay, let's go to the audience.
All right, we've got Phil in Carryong here. Phil, what's your question?
Morning, doctors. It's a two-part question and I hope you don't mind, but what would happen to the planet if humankind became extinct, and are there any creatures that, if they became extinct, would have a catastrophic effect on the planet?
To answer the second part first, insects, especially ants. Insects are absolutely crucial, and if they were to go, everything else would fall over. If humans were to go, there wouldn't be much of an effect. What we would find is that the land would then come back and get revegetated, like you see in cities, that a tree trunk will force its way through the city pavement. So these big solid cities would decay fairly rapidly. And within, and there's movies about this, 500,000 years, most of the cities would have gone to lunch. You'd find that the climate would gradually come back to normal. Life would go on the way that it was. It'd be kind of nicer, but there'd be no humans. And I kind of like humans because besides doing, we do all the good things like poetry, income tax, and weapons of mass destruction. So they're a good size to humans. So basically, the effects of humanity would be gone within a few thousand years. The pyramids would last a long time, though. They're pretty good. And the stuff we left on the moon, they'd be good for a couple of million years before the meteorite rain would make them vanish into the background dust of the moon.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, there's a good series of articles about this in the New Scientist a few years back. Happy reading. There will be an exam on this. Because you rang in, Dr. Phil, we're going to send that exam. We expect you to get 80%.
I'll do my best for you.
Thanks, Phil. We've got Aaron in WA. Dr. Aaron, you got a question about some meat. What's going on?
Good morning, doctors. My question came to me probably about a week ago when I had some old mince in the fridge that is probably 2 days past its expiry. And I was wondering, could I then heat it at high heat? Would that then kill the germs and bacteria, which would then enable me to then eat the mince?
Mm.
Yes and no, you're going into a lottery. And to give you some hard figures, and the latest ones I have are going back, I don't know, 15 years, 2010. Food carried diseases affected roughly 10% of the world's population and killed 500,000 people.
Well,
right, okay. So it can be serious. So getting back to the meat, you're entering a lottery. If the only thing that's happening to the meat, besides getting a bit slimy, there are bacteria in there, and these bacteria will do their stuff only when they're in your gut, then if you heat it up and you kill the bacteria, it'll be safe to eat, not particularly delicious. But some bacteria make toxins.
Mm.
And then these toxins, they survive when the bacteria are killed. So even though you've heated up the meat, the toxins are still there and you'll still get the food poisoning for it. I don't know, what's that line from the movie, Hey Punk, Do You Feel Lucky?
Mm.
What was that movie?
You're Feeling Lucky.
Dirty Harry?
Yeah.
Dirty Harry. So it's a lottery I wouldn't go into. You might win, you might lose the... You don't want to be one of those 500,000 people who die.
Mm-hmm. Is that I didn't take that lottery.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks.
And we've got Mazza on the Northern Rivers. Mazza, what happened to your thumbnail?
Morning, guys. Well, I stupidly smashed my thumbnail and I peeled it off yesterday, the last bit of the nail. Yeah. but underneath the nail, it's hard. I would have expected soft skin, so I was wondering if that is keratin or if it's just skin gone hard, and if it is the skin, how does it get hard?
Ah, you've got different things underneath there. So you've got something called the nail bed, which is the skin underneath the nail plate. The nail plate is that hard thing that you cut with your nail clippers. It's made from a chemical called keratin, which has exactly the same number of atoms of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen and nitrogen as your hair. Hair and fingernail are both made of keratin, but it's how they're arranged. And one of them is the beta type, and I forget which. So underneath you've got the nail plate, which is hard, which is rich in blood vessels and lots of nerves. And so you're getting that pink thing. And then up towards your joint on your thumb, you've got the nail matrix. That's the root. That's where blood comes in and out comes keratin. So from the blood, you manufacture the keratin and it extrudes forth. And the best rate we've got is about 5 centimetres a year based on somebody who measured their fingernails obsessively for about 4 or 5 decades. Nobody else has been obsessive enough to do that. Although somebody in the audience could do that and get a paper in only 4 decades from now. I mean, you could become an overnight success in 4 decades from now if you wrote the paper on it, if you did the research. And then you've got the cuticle, which is called the eponychium, and that's at your proximal or the end of your nail. That means close to the joint. And then the hyponychium is the skin under the free edge of the nail, and they help protect it. The nail plate, that's the keratin, sits on top. So you kind of got to avoid infection in it while it's healing. Is that okay now? Is it hurting?
Yeah, no, not hurting at all. It's fine. There's more to a thumbnail than I thought.
Yeah, I lost all of my toenails when I was in New Guinea. And what happened was we decided to go for a walk out to Mount Bangetta, which is the second highest mountain in New Guinea, to raise money for charity. And so they flew us up this incredibly skinny gorge and then turned hard right and landed on a runway that was maybe 100 metres long and sloped uphill. And then we started walking and I was wearing thongs and because I was turning into a hippie, so I was wearing thongs and sandals.
You're not an Aussie at all.
No, but then I had bought some boots and I hadn't tried them.
Oh, no.
And my toenails were too long. And what happened was that the toenails, as I went downhill, would dig into the front of the boot and they got really sore and painful. And on the second day, I was carried out on a stretcher by these four fit young local guys who we paid 2 shillings a day each to, which was kind of what you did in those days. I'm sorry about that. And they took me back to the hospital. And the doctor didn't like me because they thought I was a hippie. So they ripped out all my toenails without anesthetic. Without anesthetic.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I know. Okay. That was to teach me for being a hippie. Things were tough back then.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Muzza. Foot stuff is hard, particularly that kind of thing. My friend was at a concert with me the other night and she was wearing in a pair of boots. I won't say the brand because I can't, but anyone, if you know, you know. She was wearing in a very sturdy pair of boots and the blisters on the back of her heels were so bad. She needed to go to the first aid and get her foot wrapped.
Yeah.
Along with Band-Aids just to kind of hold it in place because it was like an open wound. It was insane.
Yeah, you kind of have to be lucky with boots, and most people are lucky. But when we were walking across Spain, that 790 kilometres in 5 weeks, providing I laced my shoelaces exactly the right amount of tightness, it wouldn't hurt the bone and I wouldn't get blisters. Mary, my wife, she had more latitude. My poor daughter Alice, no matter what she did, the shoes made by Western Society didn't like her and she got blisters every day for the 5 weeks it took us to walk 790 kilometres. So I'm feeling it for your friend who got blisters within a day.
I know. Oh, yeah, for real. Thing. We got Max in Eora, Sydney. Dr. Max, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. I wanted to ask if we were blasting off in a rocket above the ABC, and we were going straight into space, and no matter how far we went, we had a clear line of sight with the Triple J antenna. How far away would I get before I start to lose signal or any sort of discernible information?
Ah, that falls into the category of the unofficial motto of the United States Air Force, which is, with enough energy...
A pig will fly.
Right on, sister. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Do you know the things I say?
Of course I do.
Okay, so consider the Voyager spacecraft. They're way out past Pluto. Light takes 4 hours to get to Pluto, to the moon, 1.5 seconds, and they're about 24 hours out. And we can still pick up signals from them. If we get every stupid antenna, radio telescope antenna, on the side of the planet facing them to link together into a network. So we use the 75-metre dish at Parks, you know, from that movie, and then the 50-metre dish at Tidbinbilla, and then maybe Goldstone or Madrid, and we get enough big dishes together, we can pick up the signal. So if you're talking about the antenna on... Do people have transistor radios? Do they still exist?
I don't know.
Suppose you go to an antique store and you buy a transistor radio with an antenna. You could in town... On the ground, you've got, depending on the strength of the signal and you've got a clear line of sight, you're looking at 30 to 150 kilometres, but the Earth curves. Okay, I'm in the pay of Big Sphere. I've been told to say that, all right. But the Earth curves. So effectively maybe 80 kilometres on the ground. But straight up, if you had just the stick antenna on an old-fashioned transistor radio, you could probably pick it up, say, 200 or 300 kilometres away. The signal, imagine you've got a bubble, and as you make the bubble bigger and bigger, the surface area of the bubble gets bigger and the signal is still the same. So you got less signal per surface area of the bubble. So the signal keeps on getting weaker and weaker because the surface area that it has to cover is getting bigger. So I'm getting a couple hundred kilometres. But if you had like an antenna, say like the Parkes telescope, out at where the, you know, one light day away with the Voyager spacecraft is, you could pick it up. But you need a big, fat antenna and aimed exactly at it. Does that kind of help?
Far out. I mean, yes. And however, all of that can be foiled if you just go under into a tunnel. You lose it all.
You do. And it's weird how with some tunnels you go into, they do give you Triple J and some do not. Because they've got little receiver transmitters. And I think they should have all of the ABC radio stations, because I spent a bit of time down in Master Control in ABC in Ultimo. We have about one disaster a day around Australia, global warming, all that sort of stuff. And so it ranges from, and it's interesting listening to the radio station turn into an emergency station.
Mm.
And sometimes it's, look, parents, the radio, the bridge is down. Your kids are on the other side of the primary school. The telephone towers are down. Do not drive there. Do not use the phone. Your kids are safe. We'll let you know. Do not use the phone, because you're just going to clog up what precious airway we have. All the way back to in Darwin, I was listening to them last week as the cycling was coming in. Okay, you book tickets for such and such an event. We've spoken to the promoters. They've cancelled the event. They'll give it to you in 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting how the ABC stations do that, turn into emergency broadcasters.
100%. If ever you are in an emergency situation, always turn to your ABC local radio to get those in real-time updates. We always find that those are particularly important over summer as well. But Max, I love this hypothetical.
Thank you. You see those signs on the highway.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Tune to your local radio, yeah, for all the
government
running
radio
updates. Yeah. Liz in Boolloo, Perth, taking a bit of a turn. What's your question?
Hi, doctors. Sorry, it's another poo question. But I know what causes diarrhea, but what is actually happening in your body to make everything suddenly go from taking, what, 8 hours to digest and come out the other end to, in sometimes I'd suspect it would be minutes or less time? And what happens to all the other, basically poo, and that is already there and formed?
You're talking upon one of my favourite topics, what we call in medical land the squirts. Okay, so we're talking osmotic action. So you can do this experiment at home with some cheap cling wrap, the cheaper the better, and get something like a fish tank and get your cling wrap and get some plasticine. Do people still have plasticine?
No.
Or some sort of glue?
Yeah.
And then run it across the tank, you know, from front to back, and then have water on each side of it. And the water level's the same. The water level is the same. And the water will go through the cheap cling wrap. So if you get, for example, meat from the supermarket, and you just put it on a shelf in the fridge, that's really cheap cling wrap, and they get the cheapest they can. And you think of the plastic not as an impervious membrane, but like tangled barbed wire. The water will go through. Okay, now we're getting closer to understanding what's happening in your gut. So you've got the water level on each side of the cling wrap. You've given it a day to adjust. It's all the same. Then get a handful of salt and chuck it in on one side. And what happens is that the water will shift to try to keep the concentration of water the same. So the concentration of water, where you've added the salt, is less because you've thrown in all that salt, and the water will go to the salty side. The water will cross the membrane and go to the salty side. This is what's happening to your gut. Water goes from your blood, which is 50% salt water, into your gut. So normally, the contents of your gut, for example, you might have had some milk. It's got lactose. Lactose is two circles of carbon, you know, like six carbon atoms in a circle joined together. They can't cross the membrane but of your gut, but then lactase breaks them into two separate six-ring carbons. They go across your gut wall. If you've got, for example, diarrhea, or you've got lactose intolerance, the water goes the other way to dilute it. It crosses from your blood into the gut. And the amount of water, if you've got something really bad, like, I forget the exact name, I think for cholera, it's of the order of like 60 litres of water a day will go into your gut.
Wow.
And you don't have 60 litres of water in your body. And so cholera was known as the disease that you diagnose at breakfast and they're dead by dinner.
So is it just the chemicals, the chemical reaction in your gut that's causing that it wants to equalise it?
No, it's just little particles that are too big to cross into your bloodstream, and they're present in your gut. And so instead the water goes the other way from your blood into your gut. Instead of the particles being broken down into very small things and being shoved across into the bloodstream, they can't get broken down and they stay in your gut. And then the water goes the other way to try and dilute them out.
How does it happen so quickly?
There's a whole bunch of sodium pumps that are involved. I don't know how it happens so quickly. I do not know. That's a very good question.
Mm.
You've given me some homework. I need to know more about cholera and the squirts.
But why does it can be
it can be devastating, and sometimes it just comes upon you, and you've just got to run to the toilet.
Oh yeah,
and then you're stuck there, and you're married to the toilet bowl for a while.
Yeah, because if you could also have like you could have eaten a big meal 8 hours ago or whatever, or 6 hours ago, so there's something ready to come out, and then suddenly it all turns to.
It gets pushed by the load from above. So you've got peristaltic action. Think about a soft plastic pipe that's got porridge in it. And as you squeeze it from the outside, you can move the porridge along. So the gut has its own natural squeezing. The technical name for that is peristalsis. I do not know why it happens to such a huge degree. Thank you for that homework.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Liz. Thank you. And we've got Elin in Melbourne. What's your question?
Hi, guys. So I was listening to a podcast about these two mountaineers or ice climbers who got stuck on a mountain and they ran out of gas for their little cook stove and they couldn't have any water after that. And the podcast mentioned that eating snow does not hydrate the body. And I was like, what? That sounds really strange. So, I just wanted to know why.
The snow, freshly fallen snow, is 1/200th of the density of water. So if you're thinking, I've got a cup of water, I'll drink that. If you want to have a volume of snow that's got the same amount of water as that cup, you've got to have 200 cups of snow.
Wow.
So I'm thinking it's just the sheer volume that you can't have 200 cups of snow with your mouth getting cold each time. Mm-hmm. If it was just room temperature snow, you go, okay, I'll swallow it. But you just cannot do it in enough time to compensate for your natural dehydration anyway. Because with each breath, you're losing both carbon dioxide and water vapor. So if you weigh yourself last thing at night, first thing in the morning, your weight has gone down by 200-300 grams, and that's stuff going out through your mouth. So they just can't shovel it down fast enough. I think if we can have, I'm thinking an ice physiologist like Sam, like Dr. Ollie from who I did a podcast with at the University of Sydney. He knows so much about water and fans. If you could ring in, please, I'd be very grateful. Otherwise, anybody else who knows some physiology more than I do.
Great question.
Elin. Thank you.
We had a question earlier about drinking snow, why it doesn't really satiate the way you need it to.
Mm.
We've got Alex who has texted in and said, I'm a survival expert and the snow would lower their core temperature too much, plus they get blisters on their lips.
Right. So in a process of trying to have that 200 cups, firstly, you get blisters on your lips, and secondly, you're lowering your core temperature.
Mm.
Okay.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you, survival expert.
Yeah. Jim in Ngunnawal country, you rang in a few weeks ago. Do you want to remind us what your question was and the challenge that we set you?
Yes. So my question was, why do my friends' clothes smell better despite us using the same detergent and the same brand of washing machine?
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to do a bit of an experiment. So we had four sets of T-shirts. So two sets of T-shirts. And so we would both use each other's washing machines to see like if it was just our washing machines. And we found that whenever my clothes were being used on his machine, my clothes would end up smelling a lot more like his clothes.
I see. So you think it's your machine may be the issue?
Yes.
Wow.
Quite possibly. We also found that if we use the dryer, the detergent doesn't still have that detergent smell, where if we use it on the line, it smells a lot more like the detergent.
Wow. Okay. So firstly, you win the prize. You win
yes.
a fun pack. So please leave your name with our fabulous front desk people there and they will take care
yep.
of it. Secondly, with regard to your machine, the good news is you won a prize. The bad news is you've got to read the instruction manual. There will be instructions in the manual on how to do the regular cleaning that you're supposed to be doing on your stupid washing machine, which I've never done, but I know I should do it now. And I actually did it on my dishwasher the other day for the first time, literally ever. And luckily I asked around for advice for Choice Magazine and they gave me the right way to do it. And what I noticed was that certain items in the dishwasher were not coming through clean, even though I took off the arms and I checked that the holes were all open. So the liquid was going on. There was something else going on. And so I, what you do is you get some white vinegar and you get a wide but shallow baking tray. You pour, you put maybe a third of a litre of white vinegar in there and then you put it flat on the bottom of your dishwasher. You don't just pour the white vinegar in, because if you pour the white vinegar in, it just goes swoosh and out into the sewage system and it's gone. You put it into the shallow bowl, and the person advised me, have a smell of it before. And I took a bit of a whiff of the white vinegar and it was going, oh my God, it's really stinging my eyes. And it was only half full in the baking tray. I then put it on the hottest cycle it could, which is pots and pans, 2.5 hours, 75 degrees C. And at the end, the baking tray was full and I sniffed it and it had hardly any vinegar smell. So that means that it had filled and overflowed and filled and overflowed. So gradually, during the 2.5 hours, at each stage, vinegar was being put through the dishwasher.
Wow.
And now my plates and cups are coming through cleaner. So it's for you to have to do that if you want.
Yeah, clean the washing machine.
Whatever the instruction manual says, obey the stupid instruction. Remember the old saying, if all else fails and you've lost your temper, okay, then read the instruction manual.
Right.
But Jim, thank you so much for doing the experiment. Jim. We're going to send you a Triple J prize pack, all right? Hang on the line.
And I'll chuck in an autobiography.
And you know what? We'll give you one for your friend as well.
Oh, yeah. Alrighty. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim.
And give us your friend's name so I can give them a book as well, because they were part of the experiment, so I'll be personally autographed.
I love that. Dr. Carl, you're the best. Hey, you are listening to Science, and if you want to check out Jim's question from earlier in, I guess, the month, head back to the Triple J podcast, Science with Dr. Carl, wherever you get them, Triple J's YouTube channel as well, where you can listen back to these episodes. And we've got Jazz on the Northern Rivers. Jazz, what do you want to know?
Hi, guys. I was just wondering why spiders don't get caught in their own webs. We've got a lot of spiders at the moment because we've got a lot of rain, and I've walked through so many and they're sticking to me, and I want to know why they don't stick to their own webs.
I'm guessing you didn't read my third or fourth book back in the late 1980s?
I was born in 86, so probably not.
Probably not. Okay, so I remember doing this story and it involves somebody from the University of Oxford whose name was Volrath. V-O-L-R-A-T-H, and I followed them and I keep on seeing their name pop up, so they're some sort of spider expert. And what happens is that they have drops of liquid on their spider web which act like a spring tensioner. So they lay out the radial threads, you know, going out from the centre to the outside, a bit like the spokes on a bicycle wheel, and then they go round and round and round in a orbital fashion like the planets in the solar system. And at certain parts, they have excess thread and they put a special glue there. And the liquid winds up like a little spring-wound machine. It winds up the thread. And so when you have an insect, which is very heavy compared to the spider web, travelling at a relatively high speed, if the spider web were rigid, it is weight for weight stronger than steel, but if it were rigid, the weight of the fly would break it. But instead, it gradually pulls out. So it will stretch out maybe, you know, 10, 20, 30 centimetres against tension, winding the thread out of these little blobs of glue that they put here and there around the place. So these are called the capture threads. And part of the web is sticky and part of it is not. But the insect is big enough that it is going to firstly stick to some of the sticky parts, but secondly, the sticky parts themselves have got like a little miniature spring-wound mechanism in it. And so it, the spider web distorts by maybe 5, 10, 20 centimetres and then slows the fly down to zero and then shrinks back. and then there it is, all caught up, ready to eat.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My God, it's the first time since the late 80s I've ever used that story. Thank you so much.
It all adds up. Jesse in Meanton, Brisbane, what's your question about the speed of light? Well, the opposite of that.
Good morning, doctors. I was driving the other day with my two young boys and we were just talking about speeds of things and, you know, sort of various topics. But they asked me what the fastest sort of speed was and I suggested light speed. And they responded asking, well, does darkness have a speed and how fast would it be if we could measure it?
Ah, well, it is, as you'd kind of expect-ish, to be the same as the speed of light. In other words, the light will come in and then go away. We've got cameras now that are fast enough to catch a beam of light maybe 10 centimetres long and follow it from frame to frame. You can see that little pulse of photons going across. And so darkness is where you don't have the light, so it moves at the same speed. But to fully answer their question on what is the fastest thing, the answer is the expansion of the universe. So if you go and look up in Wikipedia inflation, you'll find that shortly after the Big Bang, for a short period of time, the fabric of space-time itself expanded at thousands of times faster than the speed of light.
Wow. Right.
So the fabric of space-time can actually expand faster than the speed of light. But within that fabric, all you can do is travel at the speed of light. But then on the other hand, look up the Alcubierre, Alcubierre effect. And suppose you want to go from the east coast to the west coast of Australia. The trouble is there's about 4,000 kilometres of space in front of you and it has a certain dimension. So what you do, using negative energy, this is theoretically possible, but nobody's ever done it because we don't know how to do it, and it involves negative mass. What the heck is negative mass? I don't know. And you need negative energy. Same deal again. Under the Alcubierre effect, what you do is you shrink the space in front of you to zero, and you expand the space behind you, and you can travel from the east coast of Australia to the west coast in zero time. Oh, my God.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, so it's called the Alcubierre effect. And because we almost certainly will work out the nature of the missing eight dimensions by the end of this century, by the time that your children reach the end of this century, we almost certainly will be able to travel from Sydney to the opposite side of the world in maybe half a second. That's a guess. It's very difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. We might get slowed down. We might not get that one. We will get dark matter, maybe not the missing dimensions.
I think they'll be very happy with that. Probably do a lot of travelling if that's the case.
I know. Thanks, Jesse. We got Carl. Oh, two Dr. Carls. Oh, Carl with a C in Ngunnawal country. What is your question?
Hi, my question's related to the expanding universe Big Bang that Dr. Carl was talking about earlier. My question is, if the universe is expanding, I'm picturing a balloon expanding into the air surrounding it. So what is on the outside of you? What's it expanding into? What is the air on the outside of the balloon in this situation?
Okay, so we'll start off by talking about the three different universes. The first universe is the Hubble limit. So the fabric of space-time is expanding, kind of like dough that you're using to make a cake in the oven. And imagine you've got raisins in there. So as the dough expands, it carries the raisins with it. And by the time they get to about 15 billion light years away from us, they are moving at the speed of light. So that's the first universe. We call that the Hubble limit universe. However, the universe is very old. And there were already things on the other side of the Hubble limit that have sent their light to us from the past, and it has crossed the Hubble limit a long time ago, and it will land in our eyeballs maybe tomorrow or the day after, and we call that the observable universe, and that's a bubble about 43 billion light years radius. And outside that is the everything universe, which we don't know how big that is because we can't measure it. We don't know anything about it much except for mathematics. And I asked a few very clever people, like Brian Schmidt, who discovered the missing 70% of the universe and won a Nobel Prize for it. He's a physicist, I knew. And I asked him what it's expanding into, and he said, the future. That's all we got. I'm sorry. That's it.
No, that's brilliant. I like it.
Well, that's why he's a Nobel Prize winner and I'm not. Yes. Sorry.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carl. We got Judy in Launceston. Judy, got a question about bubbles.
Yeah, I do. So when I have my granddaughter come over and stay, we love to play with the bubbles. And we've just noticed that they kind of come out in a colour sequence. So when you blow them, the first ones that come out tend to have a bluey-purpley tinge, and they kind of go to yellow, then to clear. And we're just wondering what causes that colour change.
Short answer, interference. Here comes a long answer. So there's an article in the Scientific American a couple of decades back called The 12 Causes of Colour. The normal one that most of us deal with on a day-to-day basis is dyes, D-Y-E. You know, so you might have a green cardigan, and the reason that it's green is it absorbs all of the other colours of the rainbow and it reflects the green. And over time, the dye will age and the colours will change. Another one of the causes of colour is related to that ancient technology called the CD or the DVD. You heard of them? Have you ever looked at the back of one and moved it around, the shiny side, and as you look at it from different angles, you see different colours flashing up?
Yes.
Okay, that's the cause of the colour in the bubbles, interference.
Okay.
Okay, so that's your second of your 12 causes of colour. And what happens is the light is going in, bouncing back, and then the waves are interfering with each other. You can see the same thing perhaps on a rainy day after a long dry spell. And if you go out maybe half an hour after it started raining and looking on the street, especially if it's smooth bitumen, there'll be little puddles of oil. And if you look at it at the right angle, you'll see these colours coming out of, you know, just out of this black oily substance on the road, which has dropped out of car engines. So it's basically the wavelengths of light going in into this very thin layer. So as the bubble evaporates away, the thickness of the bubble, the wall thickness, gets thinner and thinner. And so that changes how many wavelengths of light go backwards and forwards and interfere with each other, thus giving you the different colours. So just look up the causes of colour on Wikipedia and you'll have a good time there.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Judy. And that's our last question for this week.
Can you believe it? We didn't get to Formula One.
I know.
Next time.
A lot of people are, do you watch the Formula One?
I used to, and that was enough. It's amazing when it vibrates your body.
Yeah.
Like your whole chest is like a drum, like a music concert, of which we'll go to many over the Christmas New Year period.
Absolutely. And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. Like we said, one episode left for you to ask a question live on national radio. If you have something that you reckon is just going to be a pearler of a question to end 2025, make sure you're listening next Thursday from 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. I will be taking questions live on Triple J via 0439 75 7555 before we do the episode at 11 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. Or, of course, you can always listen back right here, wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan. I'm Lucy Smith. We'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.